Hello and welcome to another episode of the Atlas Podcast. My name is Alex. I'm joined as always by Martin. Hello, Martin.
Hello, Alex. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you doing?
Good. Really looking forward to today's episode. Some more interesting interviews and follow-up on our series around digital transformation. So, yeah. Looking forward to it.
We do indeed, yeah. First of all, we're going to be talking a bit of news. We're going to try and break down some of the news around quantum batteries, although having discussed it before the episode, it might be more of a, what exactly is this, than this is amazing. And then, as you said, yeah, we're going to continue our discussion on digital transformation. We've done people, we've done process, now we're looking at structure today. And finally, we're joined by Michael McClellan, who has a fascinating career, which I think we got about one third of the way into. So we'll have to get him back again.
Yes. So, yeah, a full program for us today. So looking forward to it.
Lots to cover. Yeah. So the first bit is quantum batteries. And this is, yeah, there have been a series of articles. Came out recently, you spotted one in The Independent, but they're all over in various like science websites talking about how quantum batteries are ultra fast charging, last for 20 years, all of these various bits and pieces, and it's a very attractive headline, but the more we dug into it, the more questions rose up about how much of this is just technobabble, and how much is genuine, because obviously as soon as you throw the word quantum out of there and or into any discussion, it gets very exciting. We know quantum computing, and I know little bits about the back of the theory of quantum entanglement and stuff like that, but I don't really see how these are any different beyond perhaps a faster charge than a traditional lithium-ion battery.
Yes, well, someone did say, if you think you'd understand quantum, then you don't understand quantum. So I think it does fall into that.
Yes. Yeah.
That arena, this one. So it's always one of those things that I think whenever you see a headline with nano or quantum in it, you kind of go, oh, that's exciting, but is it technobabble? So it definitely caught my eye, the article. And as you said, it does have links to various papers on it and things like this, but unfortunately they're behind some of the scientific institutions' paywalls, so it does mean that it's a bit more difficult to actually do a deep dive into what this is. So I think it's a nice study in trying to do some investigation and maybe being skeptical a little bit, and the concepts of technology readiness levels as well. How are we in the hype curve in the same way as we were quantum computing, and do we go into the trough of delusion before we come out the other side of these types of technologies? But maybe just give us a rundown then, Alex, of the article and what you've seen in the article yourself.
Well, yeah, I mean, this, yeah. So the article was from a paper that was released in August 2022, so recently. But it looks like the same team has been working on this for years, obviously. A lot of this news echoes some that was coming out about 18 months ago, and it seems like the real shift in the technology is around the charging. So the quantum element is using micro measures, which are single atom. Oh wait, I had it written down there. Single atom microwave analogs of lasers. So very, I assume, fine beams that use, that's how they load the energy into the battery. And then obviously with the new charging technology, there is some development in how the batteries themselves are constructed. We also have a wonderful breakdown of, because this is a team from Harvard who've put these batteries together and developed this new charging technology. And the way they describe it is you have to think of the battery like a BLT sandwich. I love a good visual. I'll pop this up on the description as well. But first comes the bread, the lithium metal anode, followed by lettuce, which is a coating of graphite. Next, a layer of tomatoes, which is the first electrolyte. Then a layer of bacon, the second electrolyte. Finish it off with a third layer of tomatoes. And the last piece of the bread is the cathode there. So if you're ever confused, just think of a BLT sandwich.
And then I feel a bit hungrier now after thinking about that.
yes.
What yeah, I do yeah. like, though, maybe you can do the honour of trying to read out the abstract from the paper, because it is just quality technobabble from start to begin. I'm sure the guys who wrote it have a strong understanding of all of these technologies that they talk about. But yeah, maybe just read out in your beautiful voice there, Alex, and we will see what people make of these the abstract that goes along with this article. Yeah,
I will give it a go. Yeah, and this is, if people are wondering, this is certainly a reading the abstract where my technical knowledge broke down. I'm like, I don't know if this is anything at all. It may well be the most amazing thing in the world. But yeah, the abstract is, we showed that a micromaser is an excellent model of quantum battery, a highly excited, pure and effectively steady state of the cavity mode, charged by coherent qubits, can be achieved also in the ultra-strong coupling regime of field-matter interaction. Stability of these appealing features against loss of coherence of the qubits and the effective of counter-rotating terms in the interaction Hamiltonian are also discussed.
I rest my case.
Yeah, I know people can't see the video, but I'm definitely having a shrug there. But it is, whatever it is fascinating, and it's even if it's technobabble to someone like me, it's a group of Harvard scientists who've been working on this for years. So there's going to be some technology in there that will, as we said with everything, it doesn't matter what you do in science, it has some sort of application somewhere down the road. 9 times out of 10, there'll be a bit of a project that gets rolled into something else and rolled into something else that then becomes the foundation of something that I can understand. Like, we'll get into an electric car at some point without
even realizing.
Absolutely,
and I think the closest we can get to this, and we discussed it before, was around the capacitor, you know, the ultra high power capacitor. I think that the guys from Lamborghini were putting into their cars. So it wasn't a battery; it was just a different storage system, and a capacitor can store things really, really quickly. Where a battery is at the moment more of a chemical process that goes with it, and as such, you can charge the capacitor very quickly, and it does discharge slower, but we are talking the difference between seconds and minutes compared to hours and days when we're talking to a battery. So there are these different systems, and I guess it also strains the terminology of what is a battery, what is a capacitor, and what is a quantum battery or a solid state battery. Ultimately, the main thing is, like you said, that we're working on these things that we might even not be conscious that charging is even occurring. And when we stop at traffic lights with our self-guided cars, charging will happen instantly without us even recognizing it's happening. Who knows?
Yeah.
But
I guess that's
in 50 years or something.
We will, for sure. And I guess that's what these technologies do, is if you think about a traditional engine, it's the transfer of energy is very quick. You put the petrol in, you set fire to the petrol, that makes the engine go. And you can store a lot of petrol in a car. So the first, I think we spoke about it when we first started the podcast, that initial challenge is getting capacity. Now they've got capacity, you've got electric cars that can go hundreds of miles. Now it's the other bits. How do we get that drive up to the pump thing going? Because at the moment, electric cars do take a while to charge, don't they? And you can't just, I mean, you can pull over at a service station, but you're going to be there for a while, compared to what you want to do, which is just plug it in and then leave again.
Well, I'm all for the slow movement. So, it gives you time to go and get a coffee or a cup of tea or something. Who knows? But anyway, yeah, it's a great dive around all the different articles to try and find out what does this mean. And we ended up with well over our head. So it's an interesting exploration anyway.
Yeah. If anybody knows, feel free to email at us, podcast@weareatlas.com. Give us a simple breakdown and we'll discuss it then.
Or if someone wants to come and explain it, that would be even better, wouldn't it? So that'd be fine.
100%. If you are a quantum science, if you're a quantum scientist, do let us know. We'll have you on in an instant.
Or
Alrighty. Oh, sorry. Did I cut you off, Martin?
no, I was going to try and whip a quick quantum pun
Go
about would they be there or not, but
on.
I didn't quite get that.
There's something in there for sure.
There is, but
We have a potential podcast guest, or we don't. We won't know until we speak to them.
Thank you.
And moving on to the tech spot part of the podcast, we're back on digital transformation. We gave a bit of an overview a couple of episodes ago. Then we looked at process last time. And this time we're looking at structure, correct? Yeah.
Excellent. Correct.
Good. I've got my. Did I get that right?
You did definitely got that right. We didn't quite get it in the intro, but we won't. We will gloss over that.
Yeah.
We've now self-corrected ourselves. I think one of the things that comes into that, Alex, is with especially with process. We started to talk a bit about process because we went from ownership, who owns the process, and almost like the stakeholders of that process,
Yeah.
thinking of things like SIPOC, supplier input, process output, customer. And what that challenges is really structures in organizations. And it's quite fundamental. We've picked up on it a couple of times. Structures in organizations happen fairly organically. So the first thing I want to talk about is really growth of a company. And then we'll move on to the structure of it. So a lot of the terminology these days is around things like startup companies or pre-startup companies, and then you go from startup to scale up and all of these types of things. So from a tech industry point of view, or any new company growing, you have this kind of organic growth that businesses go through. And each time a company gets to a certain point in its growth, 20 people, for example, then there's a bit of a plateauing over off it because the communication within that structure reaches an optimal point, and you have to break into smaller chunks for that communication to work again. So you might go from a size of 20 people startup to size of 50 people, that's a scale up, for example. Then you might go to 100 people, then 200 people. And each of these elbow points in a graph are put particular challenges on organizations from a structural point of view. And that's all to do with me about knowledge exchange. How do you get a thought from one person's mind to another person's mind? It's fine when we're sat down with the two of us, we can talk, and it's that Chinese whispers effect, isn't it? I'm talking to you, we think we're talking about the same thing, we could be talking about slightly something different. And you might then go and talk to someone else about that, and you'll put your interpretation onto that. But if one person's talking to six other people, you've got the same kind of effect going on with that knowledge exchange, apart from six people have got their own slight interpretations of this, and so on and so on and so forth. So to be able to share knowledge with an organization is quite tricky. So a small startup business, you might have an engineer, you might have somebody in marketing, you might have somebody doing the sales, and you all sit down in a room together or via Teams or whatever it is and chat. Okay, and then what happens is, oh, then you get a few more people in the marketing department, a few more people in the engineering department. And those silos start to build up because then what happens is people naturally gravitate to that conversation that's happening in the marketing space or the engineering space. And that's why these elbow points start to exist in companies, is because you get a separation of organization as well. And then the organic.
And understandably, each of those silos, because they are where they are, believes that they're doing the most important bit of it as well.
Absolutely.
So then it becomes more and more internalized,
And
yeah.
you create your own echo chambers and things like this within that.
Yeah.
So how do you stop looking internally within your group, and how do you look externally to your group to find out what's going on in other businesses, for example, or whatever that situation is. So these things grow organic. And what also happens is that those individual groups want their own tools. Because I need my marketing tool, I need my this tool, I need that tool to be able to do my job. And whether that tool is a physical tool or a software tool, means that what happens is organizations start buying particular tools for their particular domain. And so this proliferates in an organization. And then because we, at the moment, in an organization way, in an IT delivery, are in an application-centric world, we deliver and buy applications that don't necessarily talk across businesses, and haven't been designed to do that from the start upwards. So the purchasing of these things then comes. And then as a business grows, then they have an internal IT group who manage that, and then you get the separation between what the business want and the internal IT team want. So structures are really difficult to change when we talk about digital transformation. And I think this is the hardest step, because all of those things have been built into a company through their growth, and people believe they're right for what they want within their domain, and then we have this concepts of not invented here syndromes and all these different effects that cause from it. So I think we see this naturally happening in businesses, and then someone comes along and goes, well, actually I want you lot to talk together. I want to look at the end-to-end processes within a business. So the processes we talked about last week could be hire to retire processes, or they could be order fulfillment processes that cut across the stratas within a business that we've already created. But applications we buy today, or traditional applications, aren't built that way. They're built to cement the concept of the silos that you have within the business, because we want expert systems for our business. So you can define your business processes and they can live within quality systems on your dusty shelves that we talked about last week, or you can make them executable within your business and drive the change within your business and make sure that the silos are broken down, but the silos resist it because they want expert systems within those individual areas. So this is why it's a big challenge. Because you have to make everybody think, what I want is the best for the business. So I want minimum standards across my business so we get it functioning without the turbulence, without the requirement for email proliferation and all these other things that cause issues within the company. So if we do have business end-to-end business processes and we want them to be executed in the business, we've got to be thinking for the common good, not first, and not necessarily what's best for my domain, which is creates a dissonance between those two things that's quite difficult to overcome, for example. But there are things, so we'll talk about cloud technologies and platform approaches that can allow for this to occur, but we have to remember the Internet 3 technologies, the application-centric world, has been around for the last 30, 40 years, and trying to break that mindset, both of how the technology is used within a business and how businesses want the best of both worlds. We want the common standards across our business, but we want our expert systems within our own domains. Seems like opposing forces, but it's more to do with the technology platforms that have been grown up to support and cement those silos. And that's going to take a bit of change before technology catches up, or the adoption of those technologies in businesses allow for both common platforms and expert systems within the same platform.
Yes, I think one, just taking one half step back there, when you talk about those technologies that have been around for 30 to 40 years, not only that, but if you think about when they were created, the structures that they were created on have been around for potentially hundreds of years. Even sort of pre-industrial revolution, the idea that everybody works in a silo is not new. That's just a hangover from how we've always done things, basically. The initial push for technology to be a part of the workspace is built on a world where technology wasn't a part of the workspace, so it doesn't inherently lend itself to those ideas.
So some of the new technology companies, some of the Silicon Valley companies, have really been trying to challenge this. And I guess Spotify is one of the most advertised way of changing a business. So they have this kind of Spotify engineering culture, which tries to allow for both silos to be there, but brings in some other concepts and drives those concepts through the business. And those things really are as a reaction to these challenges. So these Silicon Valley companies didn't want to be the same old companies with hierarchical structures and silos and all these other things. So they started to bring in some concepts. So they brought in these concepts of squads, tribes, chapters, and guilds. And they allow for both an external and an internal view of those type of things. So squads were around the simplification of cross-functional teams that consist of something like 6 to 12 people. So communication can run very smoothly within those types of people. But there'll be a mixture of designers, developers, and business analysts. And they'll be focused on a particular function set within that application. So now you've got a nice pod of people, cross-functional, who can design things, could develop in and deliver them. Okay, great. But you don't want to scale that.
Coming back to that time to value thing that we always talk about as well. You've got, it might not be the whole product, but you can put something in that product out very quickly because, yeah, you're not going from department to department to department. It's all there in one space.
Absolutely. And I've talked to some guys who have been very successful companies, you know, have been co-founders of businesses and started them up. And they've said to me, you know, once you go beyond 12 to 20 people, especially from a software application, you put 100 people into that same structure organization, you won't get any more output from them.
Yeah.
Which sounds like
it's diminishing returns, yeah.
It's absolutely diminishing returns without there being a restructuring of how the organization operates. And that's, to me, all about how do you share knowledge effectively. And the best form of knowledge exchange we have is actually talking to each other, really. And all other methods are quite difficult to and conversation rather than being talked out. So tribes are a group of teams organized into departments. And they maybe consist of bigger. They might have 50 or 150 people, ideally around 100 people, whatever it is. So they're more your kind of traditional departments. They might be your marketing or your engineering, but they are more around what their function is, but their day-to-day work is within the squads that are producing stuff. And then you got chapters and chapters and guilds for other purposes and other reasons, but it's best that we leave people to have a look at it. But these are those kind of different organizational structures that try and get around the traditional silo mentality that are built within businesses. And that structural change can allow for more process approach across businesses as well. But, you know, there are some other concepts out there about being agile businesses and things like this. So not necessarily just agile processes, but actually having agility as a core part of any business that comes within this. And I think they're really quite challenging things. So if you're a traditional business with silos built within it today, and you're a global business, so you're not just one and you've got global silos, restructuring a business to implement digital transformation is a big ask. it's far less challenging than defining what your global processes are. Trying to restructure your business to accept global processes is another level of challenge.
It is, and it's also one of those things that, because I mean, Spotify, that model is talked about a lot. I'm sure people who listen, some of them will be familiar with it already. But it's also where a lot of companies fail when they think, well, we'll just do that. And actually, that doesn't work. The whole idea of talking about these models and demonstrating how they work differently is going, this is what works for Spotify because they're Spotify. And it's more demonstrating that you can change structure and achieve different results, but that it has to be what works for your business as well. And actually, if the traditional siloed approach isn't working, that doesn't mean 6 to 12 people squads built into tribes is going to work for you either, but there is some way of achieving agile that might work for you.
So there's interesting concepts. So, you know, so coming back to there's two words, digital transformation. Transformation in structure has a, is, you know, can be quite challenging. Or you might work beautifully as a team, harmoniously as a team, and you're all pointing in the same direction, and your siloed organization is not a problem because everybody gets on in this utopian vision that we're talking about.
Could be. And then any change would be change for change's sake, which is not great.
So, yeah, so next week we'll talk about people. And people is, in some regard, probably the easier step because it's really about ensuring that you look after your staff correctly and give them the right training so they understand what's required. Yeah.
And then
we'll touch on that next week.
Couple of episodes ahead. Technology, which is where we sit. So looking forward to that one.
Yes. So the tech spot will become the tech spot again. But anyway, digital transformation. Yeah. There you go.
We're on our way. Yeah. Okay. I think now is time we jumped into our interview with Michael McClellan. Fascinating chat. We've recorded it already. Hope you enjoy. And so, for this interview portion of the Atlas podcast, we're joined by Michael McClellan, principal at CSI, which is Collaboration Synergies, Inc. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Excellent. So, yeah, if you'd like to give us a bit of your background, how you got started with CSI, things like that, that'd be great.
Well, that's a rather long story, since now... I'm rather advanced in age, as you may already know. But
you've got a lot to tell us, then, Mike.
Well, I do.
That's the main thing.
I have more than 70 years worth. I can. That may take a while. But
we have all the time in the world.
Well, I appreciate that. There aren't too many people who have ever asked me to tell my story. They'd rather have I just stay quiet. I'm much better off in the background. But anyway. It's interesting we should meet in this. I'll start with our world of MES and factory activities. But I've spent my whole life in this business. The first 30 years of my career were in the material handling business, serving factory requirements. I've worked in factories with equipment all my life. And a number of those years I spent as president of a material handling company that we built automobile plants, not the structure, but all the insides of them for Ford, General Motors and Chrysler, did some work for Mercedes-Benz and a couple other European companies, but mostly U.S. In the mid-80s, three other people and I started a company called Integrated Production Systems, IPS. And it was the beginning of the idea for MES, for Manufacturing Execution Systems. We're talking about a time when PCs were just becoming available and just being used in the plant. And along with Honeywell Corporation, we developed an application for them to manage plant floor activities. That was in 1983. 9 years later, it became recognized as an area of business that was worthwhile. Gartner, the predecessor to Gartner, formed the MESA, and MES was off and running. But by that time, I had left the business. My company was purchased by a conveyor company, and I was installed as president. So I spent 7 years away from MES and then came back in 1996.
So you were MES before MES. This is what we're saying here, isn't it?
Yes.
You were on the ball. So what was it? Let's just hold there for a second before we go too far forward, because it's deep in our heart, the conversations that we've been having offline from this podcast around MES or manufacturing operations management and these types of things. So what was that change from moving from that material handling business to the MES or MOM world. What was the motivation behind that for you? Was there a problem that you saw that needed solving, or was it just the need to have your own business and be a bit more of an entrepreneur? What was the thing that motivated you to start that thinking?
Well, timing is kind of everything in this sense, and I can look back on some of these events that were quite game-changing at the time. But during the 70s, the PLC came into being, programmable logic controllers, and were used on plant floor systems. Computers were kind of still out in left field someplace, but they were starting to come. And my background and another gentleman, we had spent a lot of time in the stacker train, the automatic storage and retrieval systems business, which was then run through punch cards. Inventory was managed on punch cards. We had our great idea to convert those automatic storage retrieval systems to computer-driven inventory management tools. So that was our first foray. We left the conveyor industry. I left it on account of illness because my employer got sick of me and I had to go do something else. And we started off in pretty good shape, but we ended up running into this application at Honeywell where they had an extensive plant floor inventory question. And that's where we come up with a way to categorize the orders in process. And then our main thing was to be able to then manage the movement through material handling equipment through workstations. At the time, printed circuit board manufacturing was a big deal, and all printed circuit boards were built using extensive drawings carried around in tote pans. And they were, first of all, circuit boards were quite sizable, but the information required to make printed circuit boards was quite manual. It was written down, and so you carried the boards from one machine to another machine, and you did things like surface mount technology was one of the things. But it was moved by hand, and it was managed mostly just through paperwork. So that got us started in this area of combining computers with plant systems. ERP was just starting. The whole concept of an improved manufacturing set of software was just underway, and we fit in reasonably nicely. On the other hand, there were four of us in our company in Louisville, Kentucky. But at the same time, a gentleman by the name of John Golovin, who was a professor of industrial engineering in California, right across the street from Intel. And Intel put out a proposal, a request for a proposal for an MES, simply basic MES application. Mr. Golovin, whose company was Consilium, which has since gone, and our company quoted on it. He received the contract, and he went on to very significant things. He was part of Intel, essentially. We were in Kentucky, four guys who didn't know much about anything. So the business kind of evolved from that spot. The whole MES industry started from our company and John Golovin's company, Consilium. And it was just an opportunity. At the time, it looked great. We struggled, like so many software companies did. At the time, our team split up because of the turmoil within our company, as about 10,000 other small software companies did. You know, they started up about 100 of a day. So it was kind of turbulent times. Then I got a real job, and my company was acquired. And while I was back in the conveyor business, the industry pretty much took off. It was recognized, as I mentioned, by Gartner as a worthwhile thing to do, primarily driven through Intel. And there was a consortium of chip manufacturers that really pushed the original MES application. So that's how it got going.
So when you look at those kind of retrospectively, you can look at these things. You talked about all the software companies in the world and the Googles and the Silicon Valleys that came after, if you like, with the rise of technology. at the time when you looked at the computer world compared to the PLC world, you can kind of go, PLC is great automating physical equipment. Did you really think at that time that computers would be all pervasive in manufacturing? Everything revolves around manufacturing.
I was going to ask, did you have a
moment?
At that turning point, did you have an inkling
of where it's gone?
Well, I'd say, how do I want to say this? I don't think computers are very pervasive in manufacturing at all today, or they certainly were then, but the need for them and the narrow avenues that inroads that they have made. Now, I'm not talking about controllers or machine controller or machine computers. That's one aspect. I think that was pretty obvious. But the area of which we think of as either MES or MOM, management of plant floor activities, I think has simply never really taken place properly. There's a number of reasons I believe that's the case, but I think pervasive, I see more pervasive emptiness. If you go into a typical manufacturing, you know, you typically a plant will have of any size could have 100 or more PLCs, computers on the plant floor, none of which talk to each other, which is, I think, the opportunity and always has been. How do we connect those devices so that we really do have information across the value chain, not just the plant, but connecting those devices to provide a value chain that is fully flexible.
And that's a key point there. Sorry, go ahead, Alex. Go for it.
I was just going to say, we spoke to Dr. Aidan Nasihi a few weeks ago, who said something very similar. We were asking about smart manufacturing and what he thought about it. And in the Gandhi style, he said he thinks it would be a good idea. But, you know, we should try and implement it at some point.
Well, I think we're a long ways away from it. I've been part of the manufacturing 4.0. Actually, I coined an idea about 10 years ago, manufacturing 3.0, and wrote a number of papers that were published. And the idea was to look at manufacturing in a more holistic way, to think about how we link all these applications and focus on something other than these silos and the islands of information, but more into a horizontal view of what's going on as we accomplish manufacturing steps. MES is in MOM, both. I use those terms interchangeably, but both are convenient for one description, but they still do not get rid of the silos of information, nor do they have a condensed set of information that is usable in across the extended enterprise. It's just yet to come. I think that's the vision, but we haven't been able to present a framework, in my view, that is as inclusive as it should be.
And I think some people who aren't in the world that we're involved in, if you like, probably going, that sounds like quite a bold statement and maybe slightly provocative. But I think as you've been in your working life there, Michael, you've been on the shop floor and know how factories operate. The reality is there's a whole load of islands of information. There's hundreds and hundreds of applications on the shop floor, not just in the PLC domain, and there's the just as many Excel spreadsheets out there as well. And therefore, the actual, we call it brownfield site scenario, is made up of a whole load of applications that are in all kinds of technologies, from homegrown applications to Excel spreadsheets to commercially off-the-shelf products in the manufacturing space or in the quality space or in the inventory space or in the maintenance space. Each one of these things have tens or hundreds of different applications with them without any master data management particularly that centralizes it or a way of necessarily bringing data together to be able to do proper data analytics around it. And some of that, in my mind, and this is probably where we can touch on a little bit here, is because of the growth of the application-centric architectures that we have that hold their data really closely to the application and are very much formatted so the application can use that data and not so the ecosystem or the network within the factory can have access to the data. So it to me requires a shift from a application-centric world to a platform or a data architecture world with processes and things like this. So maybe describe your vision of what a idealistic architecture is and how that operates and is different from where it is today.
Well, first of all, I think we have, as you mentioned, a very narrow focus by everyone, and everyone's focus is so narrow. So collectively, in many manufacturing companies, if not most, it's departmental oriented, and everybody is defending their own turf. And unfortunately, too many people do not understand the other aspects of the business. What I think we need to do is forget about maintenance and forget about MES. I shouldn't say forget. We should not focus on these narrow applications, but the focus should be on the product itself that we're making, regardless whether that's an Oreo cookie or a Boeing airplane. It's the product that requires the focus, and there are no vendors, none that I know of software that think in that term, that how do we make a Boeing 747 or how do we make an Oreo cookie? And I think once the industry, our industry, as much as our customers' industry, begins to think about the steps within the manufacturing process, step one, step two, step three, all manufactured products are made in the same way. There's a beginning, and there's a step one, and there's a step two, and there's an end step somewhere along the line. And each one of these steps are supported with information. And if we started to focus on that, we could say that in step one, we have to check to see what the setup time is. We might check with maintenance to make sure that the equipment is ready to go. And in step two, we might do something else. But each of the steps requires information. And I think that that focus on the process itself is what's been missing. Now, the customers know how to do this. Our end user, again, the Oreo cookie manufacturer, they know how this has to work, and that is their view. But software vendors have taken a focus on their software product rather than the use of it in the factory, I think.
And so how does that all differ from you know, what you've seen today, not just from an individual application, but how end users, the end manufacturer, maybe look at purchasing these types of systems? What role do they play into driving a demand for a different approach? And is it Industry 4 or is it something else that's already been out there but not been adopted within the, you know, within the facility? So what role do they play in making this change happen that could benefit them and utilize technology in a better way?
Well, I think the way that the software products, all of them that go into the factory, have developed over the years is one instrumental aspect. And what happens is when you sit on the side of the end user and you interview vendors, it's a rather strange set of being in that the vendors come in, and I say this inclusively of all vendors, with their specific vision of what you cannot live without, Mr. Customer. You need an MES, or you need a maintenance, or you need an XYZ. It makes no difference. But the view of the customer is, I have to make an Oreo cookie, and I need information to support my Oreo cookie making process. That gap is amazing, and there are no vendors that I think, I've not seen vendors who are particularly broadly knowledgeable in any end user application. Again, I think of some of the MOM MES vendors, for example, do a great job starting off with MES and moving it horizontally in some aspects. But I know of no MES or MOM vendor who can come in and describe how Oreo cookies are made. They just don't accept that responsibility. And the customer is still waiting for that vendor, I believe, to say, well, we're ready to support how you make Oreo cookies. Yeah, we have an MES, but that's not our question. The question is, Mr. Customer, how do you make cookies? I want to learn. I'm going to go sit in your factory and see where you need information, how you set the oven temperature, how you set the conveyor speed. Where do you get your products from? So to me, it's the vision from the vendors of broadness. How do you get across that whole, and I say value chain, because I want to go from the end user in the grocery store all the way back to the beginning of that recipe for that package of Oreo cookies. That whole chain of events requires a number, and I'll pick a number, maybe 100 intersections with information from some location. But it's the breadth of that that I think the vendors have to be ready to adopt, and I'm not sure that they have done that yet.
We cut you off a little bit about, we left you in your history of... a little bit, but but it's great. We all went off into a great discussion in that space. Was there a particular incident in your working life that were quite seminal that changed what your thinking? Is there particular points in that you think there's a particular thing that happened that really shifted my thinking in this direction?
Well. Actually, there is, as a matter of fact, it's kind of a strange event, but I remember about 2001 or so, I was at a seminar at Stanford University, and IBM put on a presentation, and they described an integral set of points across the value chain that should be connected. And I can still remember the slide with about 1,000 dots up on it. And this woman was an elegant speaker. And her point was, all of these points within the value chain are part of this process. And they are a set of system dynamics that are moving. And the question is, how do we connect with those moving parts to make us a most effective set of information challenges that we can address. About that same time, I picked up the book on systems dynamics by a guy by the name of Forrester, who was one of the people who set a lot of this idea of systems in motion. And I was just taken by the dynamics of systems and the presentation that IBM had made, which I thought was quite, and I've always remembered it, just thought it was quite a moving point.
Excellent.
Bit of an epiphany moment.
Yes, it was very much so. I had been involved with, I've run factories. I've been a president of three manufacturing companies, serving manufacturing companies. And I've spent countless hours on the plant floor looking at which order is being produced. How is that in the sequence? What's next? What do we do here? Those kinds of things have just been my 60 years of working experience. So it was just a natural that to say, okay, let's just have this broader vision. Where are all the dots? How do I recognize the connection between those dots and the meaningful aspects that we need to support? The event itself has already been identified. The question now is, how do I reduce the downside as that event is addressed? How do I get rid of the problems? Because we're always going to have effects within manufacturing that change minute by minute or second by second. So the question is, how do we address all these points of action? They're not exactly points of light in a halo sense, but they're points of events that support the need for information. A machine just broke down. What do I do about that? And what does that have to do with the delivery of product to the grocery store in Yorkshire? You know, what's that mean? What's that connection all the way down to that end user?
Yeah. From the holistic down to the granular.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was just going to add, the term is granular. I mean, that was a term we used to use a lot in MES originally, was the granularity, particularly in the late 90s. MES gave you the granularity that ERP did not. I'm not sure we've addressed or embraced the concept of granularity at the level that I think is necessary.
Yeah. And the more granular they get, the more complicated it gets. I'm guessing that might be one of the barriers to why we haven't dived as... You can do it at an individual level, I think, but trying to find then the commonality across the granularity to make scale work and impact work is, especially when we talk about the supply chain and even within organizations, it's quite a challenge, I think, to share that information. Just on general, talking about if you class this as the phrase digital transformation or something like this, out of your knowledge and experience, is it the systems, the people, the structures? What are the things that you think are the biggest barriers to making this digital transformation happen?
Oh, wow. There's only about a million of them, I suppose. I don't think we have. I just don't think we have the vision that encompasses what the customers are trying to do. And I'll give you a couple of examples that I think are just kind of mind-boggling. There's a company located in Minnesota that has 1,500 plants. 1,500. They make everything from palm oil to pork chops. And everything in between. This is a global enterprise, and they've been struggling, because I've been part of this on occasion, they've been struggling to manage at the granular level across 1,500 plants. That's just a gargantuan task. Now, in the other end, I also know another company that has one plant with 200 people in it. And none of the ERP vendors want to even talk to them because it's not big enough. It's not common enough. So on both of those extremes, what you have in common is nothing. There's nothing in common about either of those two. And I think somewhere along the line, we have to address the client's perspective. And now, there are no MES systems that's ready for a 1,500 plant application. It just doesn't make sense. So they would say, well, of course, then they divide it up into 9 different business categories. Then they eventually get granular. But that's a long ways away from the grocery store that's just sold a piece of pork chop meat and has to replace it from a farm product someplace in a rural environment and make those two connections revisited again. I just sold a pork chop. How do I get a new pork chop in the place for the store customer to buy? That whole link is what has to be, I think, embraced. And manufacturing 4.0 doesn't come close to that. The digital enterprise might give us a platform that we can connect the dots. And I don't think that we'll ever have a common application for the 1,500 plant use, nor do I think we'll ever be able to have an SAP application that fits the 200 plant because it's too unique. The 200 man plant is unique. It's unique from the company next to it. And if you ever got all the, let's say, 12,000 small manufacturers in the United States to do everything exactly the same, SAP would love to sell you the software. But that's not going to happen. Those companies are always going to be unique. And they do their accounts payable for one way, and it may be odd, but they do it that way because it suits them for whatever reason. Somehow we have to reverse the idea that it can only be done by scale, that you can't get granular. And I think it has to become granular, and we have to provide the services to tie all those links together.
Excellent. We've been going for a while now, and I've just realized, Alex, we're over 27 minutes, which is probably
we've blown through time, as always.
I guess got out of
as is tradition. we'll have to come back for round two, as always. I guess in way of closing, what is there any one thing in particular that's exciting you about the future of this technology? We've talked about the fact that perhaps technology hasn't quite lived up to its full potential, but is there anything that you see on the horizon that does excite you that's coming up down the road?
Well, I'm reminded of a professor at Purdue University that I met in the early 80s when I was trying to get this idea off the ground of what we're going to do. And I was describing how MES was going to change the world. And this professor, who had a long history in manufacturing, said, well, it may not fix all the problems, but there's so many problems out there that anything will help. So, yes, you should go ahead and make it happen. And I think we're on a path to that anything helps. There's no question we've made great gains over the last 25, 30 years in manufacturing. I mean, I remember when we used to have annual forecasts and you planned 12 months in advance and you had releases and inventory was in a separate building someplace and sales forecasts were made 18 months in advance. You tried to manufacture to that. And in response, the factory got a 6-inch deep printout of what orders they had to produce in the next 30 days. That's the way we used to do things. Well, we're a long ways down the road from that. But I do think that we are just on the cusp of really making meaningful advancements in this area. The idea of digitization of, and I hate the acronyms, but because even when they talk about artificial intelligence being applied in manufacturing, you still have to say, to what are you going to apply artificial intelligence? Does that mean machine breakdowns are going to be forecast 6 weeks in advance so it doesn't upset my production schedule? Does it mean we will not have ice storms anymore and trucks will always be able to get raw materials where they're supposed to be? There's such a broad range of issues that are specific on a daily, minute-by-minute basis that we have to get in connection. And we have to do it in a way that is universal but allows uniqueness at each of these smaller companies. One thing is the 1,500 company, 1,500 plant enterprise. That's one set of issues. And as long as the meat producing industry always has huge enterprises running it, I guess they can all kind of be in their own canoe together, doing the same things, whatever works or doesn't work, they all live through. But somewhere we have to link all these things to a series of events that are predictable and manageable, yet unique to each small company. And I think we have a long ways to go. And I don't think Industry 4.0, from what I've seen, I've not seen a vision that accomplishes that.
So we look to Industry 5.0 then, or maybe the next one. We'll see.
Or maybe 8.0 or something like that. I think we got a few iterations.
We're being realistic. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Michael. It's been an absolute pleasure. And as Martin said, we got maybe a quarter of a half of what we wanted to chat about there. So we'll have to come back round again for the next bits.
Well, I'm always happy to share ideas, especially with those people who know what's going on. And certainly you guys do. And so let me know. I'll be always happy to share some more.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
And that's it for another episode of the Atlas Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me, Martin.
My pleasure, Alex.
Fascinating episode. I hope there was some confusion, there was some learning, there was Michael McClellan. Good all round, I think.
And we have quite a few things coming up as well, which is really exciting. Looking forward
to
pressing forward. So we will do this again, Alex.
Absolutely.
We will do this again.
We will. I'll see you next week for, I think, Stuart Noakes is joining us. We're going to be talking about people in terms of digital transformation and hopefully a news topic that one or either of us can understand, which would be great.
I look forward to that.
Alrighty. For more information on Atlas and the projects we're involved in, head over to weareatlas.com. And to keep up to date with us, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at ats_Atlas and on LinkedIn at ats-Atlas.